I'm Laura Kolodny. I'm a tech and business reporter for Wall Street Journal Online. I write about venture-backed companies, fast-growing companies, and so many have been using game design, game thinking, game principles lately, and the best of them are using that thinking to achieve good things in the world, social aims and health aims, and I was really excited to join you guys. Thank you.
Awesome. So, yeah, and we'll just introduce ourselves. Noreen and I had got a few slides prepared just to start, to sort of set the stage a little bit, and then Laura was going to moderate a little discussion between us. I think we'll make sure we have lots of time for questions at the end, because I suspect this is a topic everyone's got some opinions about and questions to ask. I think there's a lot still to be learned about the space, so despite the fact that Noreen and I have been doing this work now for a few years, you know, there's new things to be learned all the time, new mistakes to be made, and new achievements found. So, on that note, I will start. I'll introduce myself before my slides, and I'll let Noreen give a little bit of her background before she starts. I'm the CEO of a company called Ayogo Games, and we specialize in the application of game design principles and technology to healthcare. And education. We have an educational services division. My area of the company is primarily on the healthcare side. So I'm not a doctor or a clinician or a researcher. I'm a game designer. And so in our projects, we partner typically with a representative of the patient community that we're working with. You need to know who you're designing for. And partner typically with a clinical organization to help us set the clinical goals of what we're trying to do. Our job is to translate those goals into game design to try and get the behavior that we want from the players that are playing the game. So just a couple of quick slides, which I hope will...
So you just have to play it.
Which I hope will appear. Yes. Great. So the first point that I'd like to start with is that games aren't trivial. I mean, we think of games as being sort of a triviality, that is something that's just for entertainment purposes. But this idea of a game as something that's purely a diversion is almost entirely a modern idea. Games have always been serious. Games have always been practical. Think back to one of the very first games you ever played, you probably remember playing, Hide and Seek. Hide and seek is the reason that humanity exists. If we hadn't taught our children to hide from predators and to seek food, we wouldn't have survived as a species. It's a serious game, a very important game, you know, the most important game of all. And when you think about how it's played, that is typically parents aren't really involved. It's a social game. The kids play with themselves. They build social structures around it. They wrap it up in their day-to-day life. But they're trying to learn real skills and practice those skills in a safe environment, obviously where there are no real predators around, a safe environment so that they can habituate the necessary behaviors that take them forward to help them survive. So play is one of the most productive things that we can do. And this is, you know, relevant to healthcare in particular. 50% of patients with chronic diseases follow treatment recommendations. And here's actually a little bit more disturbing statistic that somebody in the office dug up for me for this presentation. 600,000 people have bypasses every day in the U.S., and only 10% report changing their lifestyles as a result. So, I mean, it's obvious, right? But 90% don't do that, despite the fact that they are shortening their lifespan. You know, the stakes are very, very high. So why don't we change our behavior? There's a lot of hardwired cognitive biases. I mean, evolutionary biology fights against us. You know, why do we feel especially hungry after we finished eating a donut? You know, why does fries and gravy taste more delicious than broccoli? It's cruel that nature has done this to us, but they're really bugs. You know, think of it in software terms, really bugs in the system. When human behavior mostly evolved, it didn't matter if you ate fries and gravy or broccoli because you were probably going to be dead soon. And we didn't have, our lives were brutish and short. And so we've built all this, we've evolved all this behavior That's not really suited to our modern world, to long lifespans, where decrepitude actually is the end result of most human life now, not, you know, to be a meal for a predator. So we have built in all these hardwired bugs in our software, but those of us who work in the software industry have a saying, a bug is really just an undocumented feature. So we can use these biases, you know, this bias towards instant gratification, something that it could be said a little bit more precisely is hyperbolic discounting. That is, we value pleasure that we get in the present much more highly than pleasure we get in the future, even when that pleasure in the future is very, very great. That is, you know, living a much longer life and being healthy and so on. We favor our pleasure in the present because of these hardwired biases that I talked about. And we can use these defects in the system. We can design around them to motivate the behavior that we want. So, to answer the question, how can something seemingly trivial like games use to affect our behavior? Play is nature's learning tool, as I said, but games are engagement engines. They set contexts which give us the cues to tell us how to behave. So we can construct a context in which, let me give you a more concrete example, one that I like to give. I call it the 10,000 cups of coffee problem. So I'm going to drink 10,000 cups of coffee in my life, and if I put sugar in every one of those, that would be very, very bad for me. And when I have a cup of coffee in my hand and I'm putting sugar in it, my wife might say something to me like, no, don't put sugar in that. That's really bad for you. You know, it's really bad for your health and terrible things are going to happen if you put sugar in your coffee. And I will say something back to her like, well, that's just not true. It's not true that putting sugar in this cup of coffee is going to be bad for my health, because this cup of coffee is actually irrelevant. It's the 10,000 that matter. This cup actually is not going to make any difference. And so I can discount. Realistically, one could make the choice to discount the value of that cup of coffee. But we can use a game, we can use play in the context of gameplay to recontextualize that cup of coffee. So that it's not just about the pleasure of drinking that cup of coffee, but it's part of a larger system, a social project that I'm building online with my friends, a hook that I can hang social status off when I publish to my social network. Okay, so interesting in theory. Recontextualizing the activities of your day-to-day life using games and play to motivate more appropriate behavior. Let's look at quickly just some concrete examples of projects that we've worked on. Sister Match targets women in their 50s and 60s with diabetes. So you don't really think of this as being a... I like to show this example first because it's not typically thought of as a gamer audience, right? Not 16-year-old boys. 42-year-old women are hardcore gamers of the 21st century. I'm probably preaching to the choir. You guys have probably heard that stat before, right? They have their own special way of playing, though. It's different than 16-year-old boys. Perhaps that's obvious to say. But how do we reflect it in the game design? So the goal of this project was to help women teach others with their own experiences. Now, sort of create a knowledge management system around the management of diabetes to get these women who've lived with their disease for a long time and have accumulated a lot of knowledge and wisdom about how to manage their disease, to get them to share it more effectively with each other. So how do we do that with play? Women in their 50s and 60s, we discovered in our research, mostly by asking them, they're not very competitive typically in the games they play. They like to be more cooperative, and so we structured this game called Sister Match around the idea of quilting. Our partner for this was the Diabetes Sisters Foundation, which is a great organization operating mostly out of North Carolina that pairs women together with diabetes so they can provide each other with emotional and logistical and practical support. And they do fabulous work, and we're very glad to be working with them. On their website online, we created this, or we call it the Community Quilt. The actual name of the program is Sister Match. And how it works is that there's a quilt, and each square on the quilt represents either a person, that's the big square, or represents something that somebody has done, which is the small square, that is an action that somebody has taken. And your job in this game is to fill in the quilt. So it starts off with some simple things, filling out your profile, and starts to ask you more elaborate questions, ask you to fill out questionnaires, ask you to share stories about your life. So, you know, how do you tease stories out of people? You know, you might say, you know, it's good for you to go to sleep early, so try going to bed early 3 times this week. That's good for your diabetes. Well, that's good to know. But how do we get somebody to say that they did it and promote this activity to their friends? We'll ask them to tell a story about how it affected their sex life or how it increased their productivity at work. These are the kinds of stories and storytelling that form the sort of play foundation for this particular demographic. And so we leverage that here. They tell their story. And as they tell a story, they earn a square that they can put on the quilt. And the quilt starts to fill up. It starts to fill up with stories, and it starts to fill up with people. And underneath the covers, we do something that I think is kind of clever, which is that we use a kind of personality matching algorithm, you know, think something like eHarmony, and we move the quilt blocks together of people that are more like each other. So as you're exploring the quilt, you're more likely to encounter other people whose stories are relevant to you. And so it's a playful environment, a totally cooperative, playful environment. There's no points, there's no achievements, there's no badges. Those are kind of, you know, bugbears for those of us in the game industry a long time. I'm fond of saying points and achievements are to games what page numbers and chapter headings are to literature. It's good to keep track, but it doesn't tell you whether you're keeping track of something that's worthwhile. But in any case, the stories are what we're really trying to capture here. So the quilt fills up over time. You can explore the quilt and find people telling stories about themselves and comment on those stories. So it's a recently launched project. The first 400 players shared nearly 2,500 stories in the first month and a half that we had it launched. They took 1,200 questionnaires and 740 tests. We gathered a lot of information, which is shared throughout the community. We're pretty pleased with the result. So then just quickly to talk about another project built on exactly the same game engine for a different group of people entirely, where telling the stories, the most interesting stories becomes the game. The Demikov project, this is actually unreleased, but our beta testers have loved it, working with an organization called Fuck Cancer. You'll pardon the expletive, but I just love saying it, Fuck Cancer. So they are an organization devoted to educating young people about how to discover cancer before it becomes fatal. One of the sad facts is that young people who die of cancer typically knew everything they needed to know in time to do something about it. They just didn't know what to do. They didn't know what that lump meant. They didn't know, you know, that, you know, they should speak to somebody about it. So we wanted to educate them. We thought, well, they don't really like to hear from us about what they should do. So let's get them to tell each other. So using the same, roughly the same game engine, the player is given, this is a Facebook game, the player is given a mission. And their mission is to learn everything about how to discover some particular kind of cancer, let's say testicular cancer or breast cancer. Everything you need to know to discover it, they need to understand it. That's their mission briefing. And then their mission is to, after they accept their mission becomes to create a kind of public service announcement about it. That is, they play a prank or they perform some public performance to educate their friends about the mission. And then we, you know, we show there all the different places on the map where the performances have taken place. And then they publish a video of their public service announcement online. And the ones that are distributed the most broadly, they get the most upvotes and likes, push them up the leaderboard. It's a competitive game using the same, roughly the same storytelling game engine, but now they're competing with each other to tell who can, to see who could tell the most compelling story. Here's, it's a, you know, public performances. Our beta test group, one of their performances was to get, their challenge was to get people to do breast self-examinations on the street. Can you, how many strangers can you stop on the street and let, and who will let you film them doing a breast self-exam. And has, the breast self-exam has to be done properly, and whoever, the first one who gets to 10 wins is the competition. So we filmed it. They published their video, and then they had a great time doing it. It's actually hilarious trying to talk people into letting you film them do breast self-exams or testicular exams on a bus or...
Here's the true test. Would you do one right now?
I think I'm good. So, perform a video that shows how cancer cells spread. So they do a public dance performance in a bus station so people can experience for themselves. So they're teaching each other and using play to do it. This is a group that typically wouldn't take the time to learn how to do a testicular self-exam or understand how cancer cells spread through the body. And compete to appear in a leaderboard. I've got a couple more slides, but I feel like I've already talked long enough about that. So that's just to sort of set the context about the things that we have found that actually work using games and play. We have some projects that are largely about adherence to complex drug protocols, teenagers with HIV, young kids recently diagnosed with diabetes. Adherence is also an interesting application of games where we know it can work. There are other places where games have shown a lot of promise, but there's still more research to be done. But I think we've got enough stuff in the field now that we can point to it and say that there are actually successful things that games can be used for.
I'd like to ask you guys a question just to sort of level the playing field here. What is actually defined as gamification in your field? Because I know in the realm of venture-backed startups, there's a lot of leaderboards, loyalty rewards. It's aiming to compel a purchase or a positive review of something in this business context. So what, from the health point of view, what kind of game tactics or game mechanics are included? Can you use loyalty rewards in health effectively? You just said badges are somewhat of an albatross to the industry somehow. What do you include as the game mechanics that should be used in health?
Well, as I said, I think of points and leaderboards as really like page numbers and chapter headings that help you keep track. Now, if I'm reading War and Peace and there's no page numbers or chapter headings and I have no idea how many pages there are, by the time I get about 2/3 of the way through it, I'm going to start to wonder if the thing's ever going to end, right? So they're actually important. I'm not saying that they're not important. You need to keep track, but they're only important insofar as they represent something that's truly meaningful to you. Can I develop a sense of mastery in playing Pac-Man? Well, yes, I can, and it's helpful for me to know what my high score is so I can know that I can beat it, that I beat it each time. So the points aren't actually important to the play, to the mechanic of the game, but they're actually important to my own sense of mastery. So to me, gamification is about empowering people with a sense of mastery that they are learning systems that they can control and get a sense of satisfaction out of doing so.
Are there some other strands that encompasses for you beyond leaderboards? Like what tools are sort of the best employed in health contexts?
Well, I'll start by recommending a book, which I think is fantastic. And if you haven't read it, I recommend that you do. It's called A Theory of Fun. It's a great book. It's short. It's an easy read. It's fun, actually. It's full of cartoons, and it's an entertaining read. Talking a lot about, breaking down a lot of the underlying mechanics of games. Discovery, sharing, the kinds of mechanics that you find in skill-based games where you are predicting number sequences and learning simple physical motions and building a sense of mastery that way. But all of these games are all built around understanding of a system and building a more comprehensive understanding of that system over time. That's roughly what a game is. When I pick up tic-tac-toe for the first time, I don't know what the system is, and I'm discovering it. I discover it very quickly, and it ceases to be fun. But for a short while, I'm trying to figure out what the best strategy is, and in that time, it's fun for me. And so some games work really well in short bursts. Maybe you don't want your player to play your game forever. I mean, one of the things we struggle against is, picking the right mechanics. Because there's so many things you can build a game around, but if you make a game that's really, really fun and engaging, it's sort of hard to imagine that one could do that and accomplish precisely the opposite of what you want, which is to get the person to focus on the game instead of the behavior. Ultimately, what we want for many of our games is for our players to stop playing over time. We want them to habituate the behavior and no longer need the game to motivate the behavior we want. So we want them to adhere and learn to adhere, and then that becomes a habit for which they no longer need the game mechanic. So anything that is around the discovery of a system, and there's a big, it's a great book, and there are dozens of important mechanisms depending on what kind of game you play, so it's kind of a deep topic. But that's roughly how I describe it. The discovery of a system, the understanding of a system, and ultimately the mastery of that system.
And how would you simply define gamification?
I actually see gamification as anything that can be fun. I actually also would like to throw in the social side of it, because I think you can have badges and points that are very individually based, but it really becomes much more meaningful when you start to socialize your health with how other people are performing.
So the best games have a group social component. They're not just a player in a computer system.
I think in a health context, for sure.
Mm-hmm. We're naturally social beings. So, you know, the social patterning effect is, I think, well established, that, you know, we look to other people to tell us what is the correct and appropriate way to behave.
And do you know how a theory of fun for game design, how do I pronounce this author's name? R-A-P-H-K-O-S-T-E-R? Do you know how to pronounce it?
No.
Ralph, Rafe, I'm not sure, but you can follow the author just recommended at R-A-P-H-K-O-S-T-E-R on Twitter.
Rolf Koster.
So, and how do you guys measure the success of games, and what do you know about how meaningful the results are from the games that you help develop and the games that you're studying?
Well, we typically have a pretty well understood objective. So, for teenagers with HIV, we are trying to get them to adhere to their protocol. We know that they need to take these drugs at these times, and we know pretty well from, you know, the years of research in the field, how likely they are to do that. So what is typically the variance for kids who are 16? Well, that is the needle that we are trying to move. We're trying to move that needle specifically. And so it's about, you know, it's about timing, it's about motivation in that moment, and it's about using the social pressure, the reciprocal social obligation that comes from a social game to help them, to nudge them in the right moment to adhere. So, you know, we're testing against the known metrics and seeing if we can improve them.
So any kind of improvement indicates success, even if they sort of become lifelong players? I mean, is there a time where you say maybe we could get that needle to move further or faster and get them out of the game system, as you said, adhering to a positive behavior more quickly? Where do you start to understand that?
Well, I mean, it's still early days for these kinds of projects, and I think, you know, there's a lot that we're going to learn about the effect of this over time. I mean, we haven't been doing this for 5 or 10 years. We don't have a lot of data to look at. You know, we're trying to be very careful about designing our games so that we don't get that snapback effect that I think is, you know, pretty well understood from things like smoking cessation programs and so on. If you pay people to quit smoking, they are less likely to stay non-smokers. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very, very careful about using extrinsic rewards and overwhelming the intrinsic motivation that a person has to change. So we never use money or, you know, value, economic value in our games to motivate people. We only ever use virtual rewards just for that reason, not because we think that it's wrong to do that, just we're trying to reduce the number of variables
right.
that we have to work with, and we want to make sure that our games, you know, that we they have a start, a meaningful period where people are expected to play, and then we have a kind of idea of their end.
Are there any other businesses like yours that are so focused on developing games on behalf of health organizations?
Well, I think there are a lot of groups that are doing that. I mean, a lot of insurance, a lot of the health insurance companies have development teams internally who are doing work in this area, producing games. I know Humana has done a lot of good work in the area, for example. You know, honestly, we're kind of heads down on our own work, and so we know we don't spend a lot of time looking for competitors, but or other companies doing work in this space. But we're not really aware of any other companies who are specifically focused in the way that we are in working with nonprofits to deliver games to their communities and funding those projects from private sector grants.
Did you have a presentation as well, or did I miss it? Sorry, I was late.
And I did see your question there. We'll just quickly show the second part of it. And my presentation is not too long, so... So I'll just start by saying I'm actually an academic. I'm a doctoral student, PhD candidate. And I'm working on a system that I call VivoSpace, and I'm going to be talking about the process that I'm going through in designing it. It's an online social network to motivate health behavior change. So who am I? I'm a third-year PhD candidate. Like I said, I'm studying at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I work out of a lab called MAGIC, which is the Media and Graphics Interdisciplinary Center. I think they have one of the best names I've ever heard for a lab. I just want to say I'm funded by a National Center of Excellence grant called GRAND, which is a graphics, animation, and new media. It brings together researchers from across Canada, and it's a fantastic network to be a part of. I'm also a quality leader, improving healthcare quality in the province of British Columbia for the BC Patient Safety and Quality Council. So my motivation, I think Michael summed it up really well in his introduction, but essentially we as individuals and humanity these days tend to lead a pretty sedentary life. We're very much drive to our workplace. We sit in front of our computers a lot. At home we tend to either sit back in front of our computers or watch television. And along with that comes a really poor diet. And that leads to poor health outcomes. We're seeing diabetes, type 2 diabetes now in epidemic proportions in North America. We're seeing obesity, and I think for the first time we're saying that our children will have a shorter lifespan than ourselves. So all of a sudden we're seeing a decline in our healthcare simply because we're not eating well and not moving around as much as we used to. And I just want to contrast that with the popularity of online social networks and social games. And I'm sure most everyone in this room understand the huge popularity of online social networks. There's 400 million people that use Facebook every single day, daily active users. In terms of social games like Zynga, it has really changed the way social gaming or gaming has gone. So no longer, as Michael was saying, is it for 16-year-old boys, but really for over 40 women, and now they're using it at a much larger proportion than we saw console gaming. So we're seeing, for Cityville, on this day that I grabbed this data, 13.3 million users that one day. So these are daily active users of Cityville. For Electronic Arts, which is certainly rooted in console gaming, what's at the top of their list in terms of daily active users is their social sims, so their social game. So my research question is essentially, how do you harness that motivational power of online social networks and games to promote health behavior change? And what I did is I essentially looked at all the theoretical models. So there's a ton of theoretical models that look at health behavior change. There's theoretical models that exist for use of online social networks and online social games. And I extracted the determinants of behavior and came up with the ABC framework, as I call it, or the appeal, belonging, commitment. So I've presented some of the determinants here, but there are more than that. And essentially, we have determinants such as we're using social games and online social networks for entertainment, to maintain connectivity with our friends and family, for social enhancement. And how about for health? What are the individual determinants? Our perceptions. So is having that one packet of sugar in my coffee really going to change, adversely affect my behavior? So these are all the perceptions that people have. What are the expectations? So if I really start jogging, is that really going to prevent me from having a heart attack? And then self-efficacy. Am I able to quit smoking? Am I able to run 10K? And then on top of that, the belonging refers to the social determinants of health behavior. We have things like sense of belonging. So our friends and our community really promote that sense of belonging, and the social norms within that community is what's going to determine our behavior. So often people that smoke a lot will often be in the same family or same social groups, and you tend to have group identity and group comparisons that come out of that. And then really at the crux of it all is commitment. We know that we can, you know, New Year's rolls around and we got our membership to the gym and we've got the best intentions. And then what happens come February, March, you tend to stop going to the gyms. So it's how do you maintain that behavior over time? So of course we have stages of health commitment and health behavior. And we also have reasons for continued use. So people might be using Facebook because they really love it, or it may be more normative, that they're using it because everyone else is using it. So from all these determinants, of which I've explained a few, I've developed some design guidelines. So on the appeal side of it, we have, you should be presenting something where people can maintain connectivity to friends and family. It should be entertaining. So entertainment can be created through individual rewards and incentives, which we were talking about earlier. There should be some sort of personal health informatics system, and that's a pretty big word. And essentially, what I mean by that is information to track how we're doing, what kind of calories, what kind of sodium, if it's a scheduling system for our pharmaceuticals. You should be able to see that and track that information. And there should be information to promote education. So what is iron? You know, we might hear this word all the time, but there should be information that actually explains it to us so that we can become educated about that particular health information. There should be goals. And then within that goals, there should be distant goals and also proximal goals. So what am I going to do next week? What am I going to do in 2 weeks? On the belonging side of it, to create clubs and groups so that you can develop that sense of belonging. Social norms can be created by seeing what your friends are doing and seeing what your family is doing. That's the way that social norms can develop. Having approvals, such as medical seals of approval, and it should be evidence-based. Allowing for dialogue so that people can talk about their health behavior. On the commitment side, rewards through gamification. Start and end dates are very important, rather than just having, I'm going to lose 5 pounds. By when? And competition, which is different for different people. And I just want to put that there. When I actually did my initial survey, there was a huge statistical significance between men and women. So men really wanted that competition, whereas women wanted more collaborative clubs. So from these design guidelines, I created an initial paper prototype, which looks something like this. And I'm not going to get into it, but I did evaluate it through interviews. And the results showed that the interviewees were fascinated by the socialization of health information. But there were concerns around privacy. And they also suggested that I should create clubs and groups. So based on that feedback, I created my medium fidelity prototype, so this was interactive. You can navigate through it as in HTML pages. There were JavaScript files to show changes, and I could test this in a laboratory environment. So within this, I had clubs, I had goals, and I had challenges. So the challenges were competitive, and there were rewards for completing all these tasks. This was evaluated in a lab with 36 adults, and essentially there was overall good correlation with the determinants that I had from the ABC framework. So I iterated my design again, and that's where I am currently in my doctoral studies. I'm developing my high-fidelity prototype, and the design has changed quite a bit, and it's simplified to 2 pages. So all the information is present on that first page. What we see here is a friend's being shown there. So that's to show connection to friends and family. And when you share any sort of information, you can have dialogue around that. So again, it provides connection to friends and family. At the top, it's the very simple, maybe the albatross, but I can change that. It's simply when you do complete your goals or clubs or whatever other systems that you set up, that you get a reward for that. And we have personal information system. So it's being graphed. If you do click on it, it gets to be quite big, and you can navigate through it. So you can view, you know, any sort of nutritional information and as well as activity information. So calories burned and then iron, protein, all that sort of stuff. Whatever a person is interested in, they can hide it or view it. We also have information, so if someone doesn't understand what anything means, there's a clickable question mark, and it provides more information on it, so it'll promote education. And finally, goals with start and end dates, so you can see how far you're progressing through it, almost like a campaign to see how you're doing. And the one at just below it shows a group goal, so you can see how you're doing with your friends and family, if you've chosen it to be a group goal or you've entered into someone else's goal. And then the final one that I'm showing here is the social dialogue, so that people can start to have conversations around any sort of health information that they choose to share. So that's essentially my project and my research, and there's been some publications done around that as well.
So I have a question. That doesn't look like Monopoly or Grand Theft Auto. Are you also studying design elements? What have you learned about design from this? It's very bare bones.
So I should just say, like I said, I never said that I was designing a game. There's gaming elements to it, so it's definitely not a Monopoly or anything like that. And I'm really coming at it from the social network side of it.
And how do you decide how far you have to go in the design? How do you decide if we're just going to do a simple, you know, Bejeweled level casual games or something where you have to trick it out like a really immersive, almost console 3D experience?
Yeah, so that is, you know, some of game design is science, neurochemistry, and some of it is art. And it's difficult to, express the decision-making process totally. But, you know, we always start with thinking about what is the underlying activity that we want. I mean, what are people really doing first? So, you know, if it's about diet, people are eating, obviously. So what is the already existing game of eating? So what is the game that people are already playing? And then we try to expose the natural playful element of that behavior. That's the gamification process to me, is understanding what the real game is that already exists, expose it, and then add the infrastructure around it to make it actually properly playable game with, you know, a sense of mastery and feedback and all those things that we normally expect from a game. So if the behavior is a short-term behavior, that is, we have a child who is struggling with obesity and we want them to exercise, you know, they exercise in, you know, get their heart rate to peak in 3-minute bursts with 30-second rests, for example, well, that's the behavior that we want. We want them to, you know, to do that for certain periods of time. Well, you're going to design, maybe that's an arcade game you're going to design around that, where they are playing and they're using their body as a joystick and they're playing the game. And the work that I've been doing with Dr. Saxon at the Center for Body Computing takes that precise approach. So, you know, it's a real-time console game played in the moment, and then it ends, you know, after 10 or 15 minutes of play. When we were working on changing people's diet over longer periods of time or long cycle interactions or completing, you know, drug prescriptions over the course of months, well, you know, there's a game there, a game of remembering, a game of collecting around your prescriptions, and that's played over a longer period of time. So that lends itself more to the kind of collecting game that we might find with Farmville or games like that, or Tamagotchi, where you're taking care of a pet over a long period of time. So we start with thinking about, now, what is the real game here? And then what game have we all played and thought was fun that this is like? And that's kind of our thought process. I mean, everyone's got their own, but that's how our design team works. And from there, we start to, you know, build out the what we consider to be the components of the game.
Okay, from well-known games, I mean, I think about, you know, Mario and Pac-Man, you're talking about eating, and I'm just imagining Pac-Man. You know, that's the game of eating, the original game of eating in a digital era. But what are you learning about health from games that exist just to be fun, if anything?
Well, I think, what we learn from games that exist just to be fun is you're learning about human behavior. The game industry sells you back your own brain chemistry. That's how we think of our work as game designers. We're manipulating your brain chemistry, and we're making you pay us for it. So it's about the dopamine opioid cycle of seeking, wanting, and the satisfaction of achievement. That's really what happens in games. So what is the biochemical basis of play in your game? Because ultimately, if you don't understand that, if you don't understand how the human brain responds to the play activity, well, then you don't really understand your game. You don't really understand what's fun. So that's what games teach us. You know, I mean, there's been some fabulously addictive games and built in the last 50 years, and they're very, very simple. I mean, I can't be the only one, right, who's looked up from a game of tower defense at 3 o'clock in the morning and thought, what the hell am I doing? You know, I should be working or sleeping or something. but they're enormously addictive, and because they talk to our brains almost directly, you know, and so you know that's what they've taught us. That is I think the learning that we're trying to bring to healthcare and say, you know, the things that you are trying to do are not working, not because they're not important things. They're not working because you don't apparently understand how people's brains work. You don't apparently understand what actually motivates a 42-year-old woman when she's trying to make a change to her diet. I mean, look at the things that she is doing already that are successful for her. She is on Facebook. She is playing Farmville. She is sticking with those things over very long periods of time, making sacrifices in other areas of her life, you know, coming back to her, organizing her coffee breaks at work so that she can harvest her crops. I mean, she's doing things and working. So how can we take advantage of what we learn there and do those same things, but put it in the service of not getting people to do things that they would otherwise tell you they would never do, like harvest, do like virtual chores on a virtual farm, but get people to do things that they know they want to do, but for whatever reason are having a difficult time.
What is the risk that the users, the audience, will be able to perform sort of a task in the virtual, but not in their real life, and kind of skew the results of a study? Is there ever, you know, education done through a game that implies they're in better health, or...
It's actually something I've thought of quite a bit, because it is really easy in a system such as the one I've shown, Vivo Space, to actually say, yeah, I ate broccoli when you really ate French fries, right? But I think people do that in their life anyway. There's ways to sort of, you know, program in, you know, lie detection, and really, what's the benefit of that? You know, I think there comes a point where you self-police, and if they're eating with their family and they're on the system, you know, people will be less likely to lie about something like that. Yeah, and then just also getting back to the previous question, I think, you know, you can design a game that's really interesting and really engaging, but then are they really going to be out there walking and jogging like you want them to, or on their thing playing Farmville or whatever? So really you want it to be in the background to use some of these motivational aspects, but really to be doing that behavior that you want to promote.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you bring up a good point. So there's two halves to the point that I would like to make. So one is, I mean, I talked earlier about incentivizing incorrectly, right? To make you can actually make your game too fun, or too fun in the wrong way, so that I'm incented to lie about eating broccoli as opposed to eating French fries. So you want to be careful about constructing your incentives correctly. So that's part of the question. And, you know, there are well-known tricks. People are much less likely to lie, we know, when there's a human face within eyesight. Mm-hmm. So there's just little things that you can do to help people do the right thing when they want, you know, when the stakes are relatively low. When the stakes get a lot higher, though, simply self-reporting is insufficient. So I think that, you know, there's a trend towards biometrics, and which I think is a powerful trend, a little disturbing in some ways. Maybe we'd all agree with that. You know, it's not going to be very long before I will be sitting in somewhere, and I will know everything that is happening to my body, mm-hmm. everything. I will know precisely how healthy I am. And that's good for me, maybe, and maybe good for my doctors and so on. You know, it's not hard to imagine ways in which this is potentially dangerous. But I think an exciting trend, an empowering trend, and you know, when we are doing, you know, our project with the Children's National Medical Center, and part of that study, our pilot there, is about self-reporting. So can we get the kids to take their drugs when they're supposed to? And we want to know actually if the self-reporting part of it is actually really important, because we want them to self-report, because later we're going to check them biologically and find out if they told us the truth. So we want to know if we're incenting lying or we're incenting correct activity. That's actually one of the goals of the study. So it's very important, you know, it's an important learning for us to know how far you can go with your game design and with the application of fun, and when you need to back off and use a different strategy.
And Michael, I think just to add some controversy to this panel, so we're just not nodding all the time. my sense of pervasive technologies that, you know, we'll track how far you're walking and stuff is. If you're collecting it in the background like that, what's going to actually bring people to actually look at their trends and actually look at the information? I think actually having to go on and self-report will actually allow people to look at their information more because they're on the system.
I'm trying to not agree with that. but it's true. I mean, I really like the idea, I think it's a powerful idea, of separating the measurement from the reporting. I think if when the reporting becomes simply about, you know, making yourself aware of what you just did, that's actually a really important thing in and of itself. So just if I could, you know, follow you around and I knew how many steps you took, but you didn't know.
Yeah.
That's actually that's something that's not as helpful for you as it could be. Coming back and getting you to say, well, I think that I took this many steps, and then we could say, well, actually, you took this many. So now you have a better sense of, in your own mind of, you know, of how long a step is and these kinds of things. So.
That would be revelatory for a lot of us, I think, especially about food and calorie intake,
yeah,
for sure. I asked these guys, I was connecting with investors and asking them if they thought gamification is a standalone industry. And across the board, I mean, I spoke with 10 pretty prominent, very interesting VCs, and they all said, no, it's not a standalone industry. It's, you know, a discipline that applies to just about any industry. They're all very excited about health and education and e-commerce and how gamification works in these. But I asked Dr. Saxon as well, and you guys, should games that promise a health benefit be regulated by the FDA? What do you think?
No, I don't think that they should be, in general. I mean, I think there are... I mean, I wrote a blog post that got me some negative attention a couple of years ago when I said that game designers have a power. We can make people do things that they may not otherwise do, and we have to be careful about how we utilize that. Is it good when your game is so great that the kid is just sitting on the couch for hours and hours and hours? That's a dangerous thing, and I think as an industry, we need to take responsibility. It's not enough for a game designer to say, well, I just make the games, you know. It's up to the parents to decide, right? That's not good enough. You made a product, and you need to be aware of the implications of that product. So I'm not saying that I think regulation is totally wrong, or, you know, I'm a Canadian, and so we have, you know, we feel a little bit differently up north about regulation generally, but you know, I think there's a role for the regulatory regime. However, we are trying to move quickly. We're trying to make improvements to systems that are clearly not working, and I think that it's important that we don't take something that's really a simple thing about personal choices and behavior and turn it into a medical device. That I think is a dangerous trend and overreaching on the part of the regulatory agencies.
I think that sounds really reasonable. Just to share Dr. Saxon's answer by email, which she sent me, she said, as far as regulation, it depends on the game. Typically, is the game involved in making diagnostics that influence treatment? If yes, it's subject to regulation to establish safety and efficacy. So, you know, she could see some particular slice of gamified health apps, you know, to that should be regulated, but not across the board.
I'm just wondering if we should open it up for questions.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
2 minutes left, so let's do that. If people have questions out here? Come on up.
Not that I'd be here to ask her.
Hi. So, love this, guys. I'm Nate from Atlanta, and I'm part of an entrepreneurial firm called Learn It Live. What we do, just real quickly, is we connect experts in health and wellness with users via live virtual video conferencing technology. And so,
cool.
So, this whole conference has been very enlightening in different ways that we can partner with different firms. And I came down here as an emissary for the company to get direction in terms of who we're plugging these into. These are top experts, Tony Horton from P90X, and people of his stature, nutrition and health and wellness. So what I got from this was a part of the vision that everything just kind of came together for me, and I want to see what you think about it in terms of adding gamification to the mix. So what we had is we have our experts doing live interactive sessions, so you get all the knowledge transfer, you get the education that you need, and you can ask the Q&A, get the interaction. using armbands or, you know, like body media or Nike Fuel or different things like that, we can get all the biometrics so we have the measurement and accountability and the tracking. The problem, as I was at the Health 12 event last night talking to everybody, is how do we get the incentives for people, the motivation for people to do it? And while you can't really go to a corporate wellness program and say, hey, it's going to cost you this extra amount of money to incentivize your employees, and you brought up another point where you're saying, oh, well, that actually is not perfect incentivization anyway, because then once the money goes away, they don't continue the behavior. So I'm thinking, well,
or worse. Or you can disincent the behavior, yeah.
Yes. So what if you combined, how do you feel about the synergy between gamification in, let's say, a corporate wellness environment or within patients in the healthcare system, mixed with some sort of live education, mixed with the biometric tracking? And you already linked the biometric tracking with the gaming. So I'm thinking, what if you put in that live education component? Do you have thoughts on that integration and any games that might be work well in a corporate wellness type of environment? Long question. Thanks, guys.
I mean, I can give a really short answer. I mean, I think that sounds excellent. You know, there's some people learn from other people. You know, there's, I think, an unfortunate trend in our society where people don't look to experts for information. And in part because, you know, for example, the Canadian Medical Association just put out gave advice to all the doctors in Canada saying, you guys should stay off social media. Right, for liability issues and so on. I think that is absolutely terrible. I think that's like the worst advice I've ever heard. So, you know, you're just going to clear out and just let people say anything? I mean, you're experts, and you should be offering your opinion. You should be letting people know when what they're saying is incorrect, but you should be saying why. You know, these are evidence-based systems. And I think that's really important. So, the incorporation of experts to let people establish relationships, real living human relationships with their doctors, with their clinicians. I heard a great stat yesterday. The average teenager is going to spend more time on Facebook this week than they will spend with their doctor in the next 5 years. So it would be great to help establish those human connections to the resources that make the difference for learning and to help us understand the behavior we're trying to habituate.
Yeah, and I would just echo that. I think the idea of education, but also perhaps telehealth, you know, the ability to link in all that information with, face-to-face communication with healthcare providers and clinicians.
You were talking about how money isn't really a good incentive, and I found that to be relatively peculiar, given that, you know, we have a tax code and we incentivize people to do things for a tax code, and I have corporate goals, and the more I, achieve my corporate goals, the more bonus they give me, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought that was a strange comment. Not that it was wrong or anything, but I was hoping that you can expound upon that a bit more, that how, in your opinion, money isn't a great incentive.
Could you guys hear that in the back? This is basically a question about money as a motivator and why it's not always a good idea.
Yeah, so, I mean, so start by saying that I don't think that there's anything wrong with it inherently, of course. I mean, it's just, does it work or not is the only question. And will it work in some particular circumstance? I mean, that's the only question you're trying to answer. I don't think there's anything wrong. Obviously, I get paid for my work, and I'm glad I do. That's why I can keep doing it. So, but you gave a really interesting example, though, when you said the tax code, because we know that the tax code has a distorting effect on certain parts of our economy. It's not difficult to imagine how at certain times and in certain ways, our tax code, for example, has incented precisely the wrong behavior from the corporations and so on. You know, we're talking about moving money offshore and all this kind of stuff, right? So there's plenty of examples of money being a perverse incentive. And certainly when we're talking about healthcare, there's plenty of studies, and I encourage you to do a little bit of research, actually, because I think it's a really important point, how extrinsic rewards can overwhelm intrinsic motivation, especially when they are over-applied. And there was a great study on smoking cessation, for example, that was done in the 80s, which showed a really, really clear example, and they did similar studies in the 70s with teenagers in high school and test results and so on, and found that incenting money actually overwhelmed the extrinsic motivation. They did better at first, but then when you took the money away, they started to do less afterwards. So in the workplace, a perverse incentive that, you know, demotivates extrinsic motivation, that overwhelms extrinsic motivation is unfortunate. In the high school, it's, you know, it's sad and awful. In healthcare, it's potentially tragic, right? So we always need to be really, really careful about how we are applying. I said, you know, game designers have a responsibility. You know, we have actually a pretty sharp weapon, and we just need to be cautious about how we are applying it to achieve the results that we want. Always testing, always aware. You know, we're hyper aware partly because we're not doctors, we're not clinicians. We're hyper aware that we don't know. And so we always have to be testing and careful about what it is that we're doing and looking for feedback from those who do have expertise.
There is another business exploring this from the almost the opposite angle. It's that I can think of, Sugar Crew out of Boston, mm-hmm. are a medical social network that uses gamification to help people handle their diabetes. And they do pay. They pay, you know? Sugar Crew. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the pleasure to interview them as well. But it's, you know, maybe you guys can have good study between the two of you,
yeah,
comparing
no.
and contrasting.
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. It's just not our approach.
We should have a reunion panel next year.
Yeah. No, so that's an excellent point. So if I can just reflect back what I think I heard, was that we are using money in the system now to incent behavior, and we're getting precisely the wrong result, right? I mean, there is actually, we have distorted the real economy of health. That is, it doesn't actually cost you what it truly costs you to be unhealthy. And if it did, you'd be less likely to do it, probably, but we're actually incenting the incorrect behavior by making certain foods a lot cheaper than they would naturally otherwise be, and so on. So, I mean, I think, so fundamentally, I agree with your point, you know, that there is a distortion to the economy. We're actually creating financial incentives where they don't belong.
I see they're opening the doors, which means we should clear out soon. Maybe we have time for one last question.
Hi. A big takeaway that I got from just these conferences and events is sort of the social aspect of health and changing behavior. And I kind of liked your example of using Tamagotchi as something you take care of, like a pet. I was wondering if there's something like that for health games, you know, where instead of taking care of a pet, you take care of maybe some sick person, like maybe a family member or something, and you sort of support them and through some sort of gaming interface, kind of like a co-op, you know, instead of playing Left 4 Dead, you know, helping someone, shoot a zombie or, you know, throw them a health pack, you throw them a salad bar or something. I don't know. I was just wondering if you've seen any kind of those co-op health games for that.
Yeah, I have, actually. There's, I was trying to remember the name of it. There's a company in Vancouver, and I was just down speaking. I'm going to dig up the name of this company, and I'm going to post it to my Twitter feed for you. They let people create focused social networks around care providers. So, you know, one of the challenges when somebody in your family develops Alzheimer's or
is it Ties?
Yeah, Ties. Yes, thank you. Yeah, Ties.
T-Y-Z-E.
Yeah. Yeah. So they don't specifically use gamification exactly, but they do use social networking and a lot of the techniques of Facebook and the social networks to bring people together to help. Because typically, you know, the eldest daughter is the one who gets has the work fall on her, and you know, to broaden that network and use, you know, these tools of social networking to sort of, you know, bring it make it more visible and get people to participate more. And I was actually talking with them about adding some gamification, simple gamification mm-hmm. techniques to the system to help people to contribute.
If you follow the hashtag Ayogo, you'll see some these the book and mentions of these other companies. I tweeted a few things, hopefully to help you guys keep track.
And Ties is a great company.
Do we can we handle one more question? There was one gentleman waiting. Okay, great.
Great.
So it'll be our last one. All right. Thank you.
Two more.
Oh, two more.
my question is about kind of whether or not people you experience have kind of social network. So I'm kind of targeting my question at Noreen about kind of social network fatigue, and we join a lot of social networks, and we sort of there's always new things that we're kind of pressured to join and these sorts of things. So my concern about developing something like VivoSpace is that it's becoming a separate network. And I wonder if you've given any thought or like seen any research or anything like that. And maybe, Michael, you can kind of weigh on this too, because is it to our advantage to make separate networks that take advantage of those real networking opportunities and social networking opportunities? Or do we go with building a Facebook app that builds into the existing network?
It's a fantastic question. And I actually struggle with it a little bit. But I see a health group or a social network as being a little bit more private than something like Facebook, where I might have an encounter with someone at South By and all of a sudden they're my Facebook friend, but I don't want them to know how much I'm not exercising or eating, but really someone who might be in my diabetes group in my integrative health clinic, I would be more inclined to share that information. So I really lean towards the side of a separate social network where you have, it's a lot smaller. It's not the 3,000 plus, people anymore. It's maybe 20. And then you have more control over it, and you can perhaps share to Facebook if you want to.
Yeah, so I've actually been sort of more my background even than games, really, is building social networking applications going back to the mid-90s. And I used to fight against the idea of calling Facebook a social network at all. I mean, I know that ship sailed, so I'm not going to make the arguments now about it, but it's not a social network, right? It's a software system for expressing a particular social network. Human beings are not nodes. Human beings are people, right? And so you have a social network. You have a dozen social networks, maybe more. And Facebook is one particular one that is everybody you know in the world, right? That's that one network. And it makes good sense for Facebook to be highly optimized for expressing that particular network, because that's obviously good for their business. They are especially poor at expressing other social networks, many of the other ones that we have. And you think about the work of Robin Dunbar in this area, I think is really excellent and a really good read. He's the one, that Gladwell popularized the idea of Dunbar's number, this number after which you can't properly maintain the number of people in your social network. You know, teams grow to a certain size and then 152 or whatever the number is. But you have a network. If you're an average person, you have a network that's about eight people that you would jump in front of a bus for. That's a real social network. Those are real people. It's a real existing network. And there's a slightly larger one that's, a dozen or so of people that you would lend money to without questioning and so on. And so we have all these networks, inside networks. A lot of them overlap. The health network, the people who care about your health, people that you trust with information about your health, whose advice you would follow, is not the same as your Facebook social network. But it's a subset. Facebook's really, really useful. We use it a lot in our games for getting their social graph so we can get all the people. And then from all those people, you get the subset that you want to use in your particular app. So I think it's really important when you think about how social networks really work, real social networks, not the software ones. It's about people and trust relationships between people. And they're different for healthcare than they are for other things.
Go ahead.
My question is about data protection. You talked about privacy. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you've come into that issue of actually sharing your data in Facebook or wherever in another application with third parties, if there's any legal implications?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just a pure researcher in the practical world, for sure. Where you're storing the data, how secure the data is on that server becomes much more of a reason. So from my perspective, from a user perspective, is having pure control over who sees that data, rather than I think I set my privacy settings. I'm not sure who's seen it. I think it needs to be highly visible and very clear. And first and foremost, it needs to be private, and then the user can share it. But in terms of the whole, is it on American soil or Canadian soil, I think becomes much more important for the work that Michael's doing.
Yeah, I mean, so privacy is not just one thing. I mean, there are lots of different kinds of privacy. I'm fond of saying it doesn't matter what you set your privacy settings to. Everything's public to Facebook. Right, Facebook knows everything. So you can set your, and it's funny, people are so worried about some other person that they don't really know finding out about their personal information, but anyone who knows, it's a large group of people at Facebook, can just find out anything they want. Yeah, for sure. So with that in mind, right, there's one thing, the privacy from other people that you don't know, other individual people, other private citizens, that kind of privacy is really important, obviously, but we understand that kind of privacy really well. We've been building public software systems on the internet for a long time. So that kind of like, did we get hacked and are you exposing the information to other people that you don't expose accidentally through your privacy settings? That kind of... Yeah. So that's a design and user interface design problem for the most part. I think the underlying technology is well understood. There's a whole regulatory regime, though, around how you share data, and the rules are different in Canada than they are in the United States. And you need to be really, really aware of it. You know, it's important, especially given that so many of the business models for so many companies like us and other companies working in the space are built around that data. Our business models are actually built around the data and the access to the data and the use of the data. So, you know, for example, I mean, we're able to give the applications that we build to the nonprofits we work with for free because we can utilize the data that's generated inside those applications to help people design better products, better health products. So if I'm making a glucose meter, if I know when and how people are having a difficult time using their glucose meters, that's a really, really useful information for me. And I want to know it. So how do you get the information from A to B, how you carry it is important. You need to be transparent about it, and you need to make sure that data is properly anonymized and all those things. Again, relatively well-understood problems. They're not technical problems, though. They're business problems and issues of trust. I think our regulatory regimes, the regulatory regimes in Europe and in Canada, frankly, are much better than they are in the United States, and we conform with the Canadian and European regulations about the transfer of data between organizations. But something that we should all be thinking about. When I see the Privacy Act, and then it doesn't address this particular issue, which is who watches the watchmen, I think we could stand to spend more attention focusing on that problem.
I think we've maximized the use of this room. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's an amazing business. It's a really good idea.
Thanks. And thanks to our great moderator. That was fantastic.